Chapter 17. The Launching of World War II. At daybreak on September 1, 1939, the very date which Hitler had set in his first directive for Case White back on April 3rd, the German armies poured across the Polish frontier and converged on Warsaw from the north, south, and west. Overhead, German warplanes roared toward their targets. Polish troop columns and ammunition dumps, bridges, railroads, and open cities. Within a few minutes, they were giving the Poles, soldiers and civilians alike, the first taste of sudden death and destruction from the skies ever experienced on any great scale on the earth, and thereby inaugurating a terror which would become dreadfully familiar to hundreds of millions of men, women, and children in Europe and Asia during the next 6 years, and whose shadow, after the nuclear bombs came, would haunt all mankind with the threat of utter extinction. It was a gray, somewhat sultry morning in Berlin, with clouds hanging low over the city, giving it some protection from hostile bombers, which were feared but never came. The people in the streets, I noticed, were apathetic despite the immensity of the news which had greeted them from their radios and from the extra editions of the morning newspapers. Hitler's proclamation to the army announcing the opening of hostilities was broadcast over the German radio at 5:40 a.m., and the newspaper extras were on the street shortly after. Across the street from the Adlon Hotel, the morning shift of laborers had gone to work on the new IG Farben building just as if nothing had happened, and when newsboys came by shouting their extras, no one laid down his tools to buy one. Perhaps, it occurred to me, the German people were simply dazed at waking up on this first morning of September to find themselves in a war which they had been sure the Führer somehow would avoid. They could not quite believe it now that it had come. What a contrast, one could not help thinking, between this gray apathy and the way the Germans had gone to war in 1914. Then there had been a wild enthusiasm. The crowds in the street had staged delirious demonstrations, tossed flowers at the marching troops, and frantically cheered the Kaiser and Supreme Warlord, Wilhelm II. There were no such demonstrations this time for the troops or for the Nazi warlord, who shortly before 10 a.m. drove from the Chancellery to the Reichstag through empty streets to address the nation on the momentous happenings which he himself, deliberately and cold-bloodedly, had just provoked. Even the robot members of the Reichstag, party hacks for the most part, whom Hitler had appointed, failed to respond with much enthusiasm as the dictator launched into his explanation of why Germany found itself on this morning engaged in war. There was far less cheering than on previous and less important occasions when the leader had declaimed from this tribune in the ornate hall of the Kroll Opera House. Though truculent at times, he seemed strangely on the defensive, and throughout the speech, I thought as I listened, ran a curious strain, as though he himself were dazed at the fix he had got himself into and felt a little desperate about it. His explanation of why his Italian ally had reneged on its automatic obligations to come to his aid did not seem to go over even with this hand-picked audience. "I should like," he said, "here above all, to thank Italy, which throughout has supported us, but you will understand that for the carrying out of this struggle we do not intend to appeal for foreign help. We will carry out this task ourselves." Having lied so often on his way to power and in his consolidation of power, Hitler could not refrain at this serious moment in history from thundering a few more lies to the gullible German people in justification of his wanton act. "You know the endless attempts I made for a peaceful clarification and understanding of the problem of Austria, and later of the problem of the Sudetenland, Bohemia, and Moravia. It was all in vain. In my talks with Polish statesmen, I formulated at last the German proposals, and there is nothing more modest or loyal than these proposals. I should like to say this to the world. I alone was in the position to make such proposals, for I know very well that in doing so I brought myself into opposition to millions of Germans. These proposals have been refused. For 2 whole days I sat with my government and waited to see whether it was convenient for the Polish government to send a plenipotentiary or not. But I am wrongly judged if my love of peace and my patience are mistaken for weakness or even cowardice. I can no longer find any willingness on the part of the Polish government to conduct serious negotiations with us. I have therefore resolved to speak to Poland in the same language that Poland for months past has used toward us. This night, for the first time, Polish regular soldiers fired on our own territory. Since 5:45 a.m. we have been returning the fire, and from now on bombs will be met with bombs. Thus was the faked German attack on the German radio station at Gliwice, which, as we have seen, was carried out by SS men in Polish uniforms under the direction of Naujoks, used by the Chancellor of Germany as justification of his cold-blooded aggression against Poland. And indeed, in its first communiques, the German High Command referred to its military operations as a counterattack. Even Weizsäcker did his best to perpetrate this shabby swindle. During the day, he got off a circular telegram from the Foreign Office to all German diplomatic missions abroad, advising them on the line they were to take. In defense against Polish attacks, German troops moved into action against Poland at dawn today. This action is for the present not to be described as war, but merely as engagements which have been brought about by Polish attacks. Even the German soldiers, who could see for themselves who had done the attacking on the Polish border, were bombarded with Hitler's lie. In a grandiose proclamation to the German army on September 1st, the Führer said, "The Polish state has refused the peaceful settlement of relations which I desired, and has appealed to arms. A series of violations of the frontier, intolerable to a great power, prove that Poland is no longer willing to respect the frontier of the Reich. In order to put an end to this lunacy, I have no other choice than to meet force with force from now on." Only once that day did Hitler utter the truth. "I am asking of no German man," he told the Reichstag, "more than I myself was ready throughout 4 years to do. I am from now on just the first soldier of the German Reich. I have once more put on that coat that was most sacred and dear to me. I will not take it off again until victory is secured, or I will not survive the outcome." In the end, this once, he would prove as good as his word. But no German I met in Berlin that day noticed that what the leader was saying quite bluntly was that he could not face, not take, defeat should it come. In his speech, Hitler named Göring as his successor should anything happen to him. Hess, he added, would be next in line. "Should anything happen to Hess," Hitler advised, "then by law the Senate will be called and will choose from its midst the most worthy, that is to say, the bravest successor." What law? What Senate? Neither existed. Hitler's relatively subdued manner at the Reichstag gave way to another and uglier mood as soon as he had returned to the Chancellery. The ubiquitous Dollarus, in tow of Göring, found him there in an exceedingly nervous and very agitated state. "He told me," the Swedish mediator later testified, "he had all along suspected that England wanted the war. He told me further that he would crush Poland and annex the whole country. He grew more and more excited and began to wave his arms as he shouted in my face, 'If England wants to fight for a year, I shall fight for a year. If England wants to fight 2 years, I shall fight 2 years.' He paused and then yelled, his voice rising to a shrill scream and his arms milling wildly, 'If England wants to fight for 3 years, I shall fight for 3 years.' The movements of his body now began to follow those of his arms, and when he finally bellowed, 'Und wenn es erforderlich ist, will ich 10 Jahre kämpfen,' 'And if necessary, I will fight for 10 years,' he brandished his fist and bent down so that it nearly touched the floor. Yet, for all his hysteria, Hitler was by no means convinced that he would have to fight Great Britain at all. It was now past noon. German armored columns were already several miles inside Poland and advancing rapidly, and most of Poland's cities, including Warsaw, had been bombed with considerable civilian casualties. But there was not a word from London or Paris that Britain and France were in any hurry to honor their word to Poland. Their course seemed clear, but Dollarus and Henderson appeared to be doing their best to confuse it. At 10:30 a.m., the British ambassador telephoned a message to Halifax. "I understand," he said, "that the Poles blew up the Dirschau Bridge during the night, and that fighting took place with the Danzigers. On receipt of this news, Hitler gave orders for the Poles to be driven back from the border line and to Göring for destruction of the Polish air force along the frontier." Only at the end of his dispatch did Henderson add, "This information comes from Göring himself. Hitler may ask to see me after Reichstag as a last effort to save the peace. What peace? Peace for Britain? For 6 hours, Germany had been waging war, with all its military might, against Britain's ally. The German operation to seize the Dirschau Bridge over the Vistula before the Poles could blow it up had been planned early in the summer, and appears constantly in the papers for Case White. It was specifically ordered in Hitler's Directive No. 1 on August 31st. Actually, the operation failed, partly because early morning fog hampered the dropping of paratroopers who were to seize the bridge. The Poles succeeded in blowing it up just in time. Hitler did not send for Henderson after his Reichstag speech, and the ambassador, who had accommodatingly passed along to London Goering's lies about the Poles beginning the attack, became discouraged, but not completely discouraged. At 10:50 a.m., he telephoned a further message to Halifax. A new idea had sprung up in his fertile but confused mind. "I feel it my duty," he reported, "however little prospect there may be of its realization, to express the belief that the only possible hope now for peace would be for Marshal Smigliritz to announce his readiness to come immediately to Germany, to discuss as soldier and plenipotentiary the whole question with Field Marshal Goering." It does not seem to have occurred to this singular British ambassador that Marshal Smigliritz might have his hands full trying to repel the massive and unprovoked German attack, or that if he could break off and did come to Berlin as a plenipotentiary, it would be equivalent under the circumstances to surrender. The Poles might be quickly beaten, but they would not surrender. Dollarus was even more active than Henderson during this first day of the German attack on Poland. At 8 a.m. he had gone to see Goering, who told him that war had broken out because the Poles had attacked the radio station at Gliwice and blown up a bridge near Dirschau. The Swede immediately rang up the Foreign Office in London with the news. "I informed somebody," he later testified in cross-examination at Nuremberg, "that according to the information I had received, the Poles had attacked, and they naturally wondered what was happening to me when I gave that information." But after all, it was only what His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin would be telephoning a couple of hours later. A confidential British Foreign Office memorandum records the Swede's call at 9:05 a.m. Aping Goering, Dollarus insisted to London that the Poles are sabotaging everything, and that he had evidence they never meant to attempt to negotiate. At half after noon, Dollarus was on the long-distance phone again to the Foreign Office in London, and this time got Cadogan. He again blamed the Poles for sabotaging the peace by blowing the Dirschau Bridge, and suggested that he once again fly to London with Forbes. But the stern and unappeasing Cadogan had had about enough of Dollarus now that the war which he had tried to prevent had come. He told the Swede that nothing could now be done. But Cadogan was merely the permanent undersecretary for foreign affairs, not even a member of the cabinet. Dollarus insisted that his request be submitted to the cabinet itself, informing Cadogan haughtily that he would ring back in an hour. This he did, and got his answer. "Any idea of mediation," Cadogan said, "while German troops are invading Poland is quite out of the question. The only way in which a world war can be stopped is, one, that hostilities be suspended, and two, that German troops be immediately withdrawn from Polish territory." At 10 a.m., the Polish ambassador in London, Count Raczynski, had called on Lord Halifax and officially communicated to him the news of the German aggression, adding that it was a plain case as provided for by the treaty. The foreign secretary answered that he had no doubt of the facts. At 10:50, he summoned the German chargé d'affaires, Theodor Kurt, to the Foreign Office and asked him if he had any information. Kurt replied that he had neither information about a German attack on Poland nor any instructions. Halifax then declared that the reports which he had received create a very serious situation. But further than that, he did not go. Kurt telephoned this information to Berlin at 11:45 a.m. By noon, then, Hitler had reason to hope that Britain, though it considered the situation serious, might not go to war after all. But the hope was soon to be dashed. At 7:15 p.m., a member of the British Embassy in Berlin telephoned the German Foreign Office and requested Ribbentrop to receive Henderson and Coulondre on a matter of urgency, as soon as possible. The French embassy made a similar request a few minutes later. Ribbentrop, having declined to meet the two ambassadors together, received Henderson at 9 p.m. and Coulondre an hour later. From the British ambassador, he was handed a formal note from the British government. "Unless the German government are prepared," it said, "to give His Majesty's government satisfactory assurances that the German government have suspended all aggressive action against Poland and are prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government will without hesitation fulfill their obligation to Poland." The French communication was in identical words. To both ambassadors, Ribbentrop replied that he would transmit their notes to Hitler, whereupon he launched into a lengthy dissertation declaring that there was no question of German aggression, but of Polish aggression, and repeated the by now somewhat stale lie that regular Polish troops had attacked German soil on the previous day. Still, the diplomatic niceties were maintained. Sir Neville Henderson did not fail to note in his dispatch that night, describing the meeting, that Ribbentrop had been courteous and polite. As the ambassador prepared to take his leave, an argument arose as to whether the German foreign minister had gabbled the text of the German proposals to Poland at their stormy meeting 2 evenings before. Henderson said he had. Ribbentrop said he had read them slowly and clearly, and even given oral explanations of the main points, so that he could suppose Henderson had understood everything. It was an argument that would never be settled, but what difference did it make now? On the night of September 1st, as the German armies penetrated further into Poland and the Luftwaffe bombed and bombed, Hitler knew from the Anglo-French notes that unless he stopped his armies and quickly withdrew them, which was unthinkable, he had a world war on his hands. Or did he still hope that night that his luck, his Munich luck, might hold? For his friend Mussolini, frightened by the advent of war and fearing that an overwhelming Anglo-French naval and military force might strike against Italy, was desperately trying to arrange another Munich. The last-minute intervention of Mussolini. As late as August 26th, it will be remembered, the Duce, in ducking out of Italy's obligation under the Pact of Steel, had insisted to the Führer that there was still a possibility of a political solution which would give full moral and material satisfaction to Germany. Hitler had not bothered to argue the matter with his friend and ally, and this had discouraged the junior partner in the Axis. Nevertheless, on August 31st, as we have seen, Mussolini and Ciano, after being advised by their ambassador in Berlin that the situation had become desperate, had urged Hitler at least to see the Polish ambassador, Lipski, and had informed him that they were trying to get the British government to agree to the return of Danzig as a first step in peace negotiations. But it was too late for Hitler to be tempted by such small bait. Danzig was a mere pretense, as the Führer had told his generals. What he wanted was to destroy Poland. But the Duce did not know this. On the morning of September 1st, he himself was confronted with the choice of immediately declaring Italy's neutrality or risking an attack by Britain and France. Ciano's diary entries make clear what a nightmare this prospect was for his deflated father-in-law. Actually, Mussolini's decision was conveyed to Britain the night before. At 11:15 p.m. on August 31st, the Foreign Office received a message from Sir Percy Lorraine in Rome. "Decision of the Italian government is taken. Italy will not fight against either England or France. This communication made to me by Ciano at 21:15, 9:15 p.m., under seal of secrecy." That evening, the Italians had been given a scare by the British cutting off all telephone communication with Rome after 8 p.m. Ciano feared it might be the prelude to an Anglo-French attack. Early on the morning of September 1st, the unhappy Italian dictator personally telephoned Ambassador Attolico in Berlin and, in the words of Ciano, urged him to entreat Hitler to send him a telegram releasing him from the obligations of the alliance. The Führer quickly and even graciously obliged. Just before he left for the Reichstag at 9:40 a.m., he got off a telegram to his friend, which was telephoned through to the German embassy in Rome to save time. "Duce, I thank you most cordially for the diplomatic and political support which you have been giving recently to Germany and her just cause. I am convinced that we can carry out the task imposed on us with the military forces of Germany. I do not therefore expect to need Italy's military support in these circumstances. I also thank you, Duce, for everything which you will do in future for the common cause of fascism and national socialism. Adolf Hitler." At 4:30 p.m., following a meeting of the Council of Ministers in Rome, the Italian radio broadcast the Council's announcement to the Italian people that Italy will take no initiative in the way of military operations. Immediately afterward, Hitler's message to Mussolini releasing Italy from its obligations was broadcast. At 12:45 p.m., after having addressed the Reichstag and after having apparently recovered from the effects of his outburst to Dolores, Hitler was moved to send a further message to Mussolini, declaring that he had been prepared to solve the Polish problem by negotiation, and that for 2 whole days I have waited in vain for a Polish negotiator, and that last night alone there were 14 more cases of frontier violation, and that consequently he had now decided to answer force with force. He again expressed his gratitude to his Welshing partner. I thank you, Duce, for all your efforts. I thank you in particular also for your offers of mediation. But from the start I was skeptical about these attempts, because the Polish government, if they had had even the slightest intention of solving the matter amicably, could have done so at any time, but they refused. For this reason, Duce, I did not want to expose you to the danger of assuming the role of mediator, which, in view of the Polish government's intransigent attitude, would in all possibility have been in vain. Adolf Hitler. But Mussolini, prompted by Ciano, made one last desperate effort to expose himself to the danger of being a mediator. Already on the previous day, shortly after noon, Ciano had proposed to the British and French ambassadors in Rome that, if their governments agreed, Mussolini would invite Germany to a conference on September 5th for the purpose of examining the clauses of the Treaty of Versailles which are the cause of the present troubles. It might have been thought that the news of the German invasion of Poland the next morning would have rendered Mussolini's proposal superfluous, but the Italians' surprise, Georges Bonnet, the French foreign minister and master appeaser, telephoned François Poncet, who was now the ambassador of France in Rome, at 11:45 a.m. on September 1st, and asked him to tell Ciano that the French government welcomed such a conference, provided that it did not try to deal with problems of countries not represented, and that it did not restrict itself to seeking partial and provisional solutions for limited and immediate problems. Bonnet made no mention of any withdrawal of German troops or even of their halting as a condition for such a conference. Twice during the afternoon of September 1st, Bonnet instructed Noel, the French ambassador in Warsaw, to ask Beck if Poland would accept the Italian proposal for a conference. Later that evening, he received his reply. We are in the midst of war as the result of unprovoked aggression. It is no longer a question of a conference, but of common action which the Allies should take to resist. Bonnet's messages and Beck's reply are in the French Yellow Book. The British government did not associate itself with Bonnet's efforts. A Foreign Office memorandum signed by R.M. Makins notes that the British government was neither consulted nor informed of this démarche. But the British were insistent upon that condition, and succeeded in carrying the badly divided French cabinet along with them, so that identical warning notes could be delivered in Berlin on the evening of September 1st. Since the text of those notes, giving notice that Britain and France would go to war unless the German troops were withdrawn from Poland, was made public the same evening, it is interesting that Mussolini, now clutching desperately at every straw, or even at straws which were not there, went ahead the next morning in a further appeal to Hitler, just as if he, the Duce, did not take the Anglo-French warnings at face value. September 2nd, as Henderson noted in his final report, was a day of suspense. The previous afternoon, on instructions from Halifax, Henderson had burned his ciphers and confidential documents and officially requested the United States chargé d'affaires to be good enough to take charge of British interests in the event of war. British Blue Book, page 21. He and Cullandre waited anxiously for Hitler's reply to their notes, but none came. Shortly after midday, Attolico, somewhat out of breath, arrived at the British embassy and told Henderson he must know one thing immediately. Was the British note of the previous evening an ultimatum or not? I told him, Henderson later wrote, that I had been authorized to tell the Minister of Foreign Affairs, if he had asked me, which he had not done, that it was not an ultimatum but a warning. Having received his answer, the Italian ambassador hastened down the Wilhelmstrasse to the German Foreign Office. Attolico had arrived at 10 o'clock that morning at the Wilhelmstrasse with a communication from Mussolini, and, being told that Ribbentrop was unwell, handed it to Weizsäcker. September 2, 1939. For purposes of information, Italy wishes to make known, naturally leaving any decision to the Führer, that she still has the possibility of getting France, Britain, and Poland to agree to a conference on the following bases. 1. An armistice, which leaves the armies where they are now. 2. Convening of the conference within 2 to 3 days. 3. Settlement of the Polish-German dispute, which, as matters stand today, would certainly be favorable to Germany. The idea, which originally emanated from the Duce, is now supported particularly by France. Ciano claims that the note was sent as the result of French pressure, Ciano Diaries, page 136. But this is surely misleading. Though Bonnet was doing all he could to get a conference, Mussolini was pushing the proposal even more desperately. Danzig is already German, and Germany has already in her hands pledges which guarantee her the greater part of her claims. Moreover, Germany has already had her moral satisfaction. If she accepted the proposal for a conference, she would achieve all her aims and at the same time avoid a war, which even now looks like becoming general and of extremely long duration. The Duce does not want to insist, but it is of the greatest moment to him that the above should be immediately brought to the attention of Herr von Ribbentrop and the Führer. No wonder that when Ribbentrop, who had quickly recovered from his indisposition, saw Atolico at 12:30 p.m., he pointed out that the Duce's proposal could not be reconciled with the Anglo-French notes of the evening before, which had the character of an ultimatum. The Italian ambassador, who was as anxious as his chief to avoid a world war and certainly more sincere, interrupted Ribbentrop to say that the British and French declarations had been superseded by the latest communication from the Duce. Atolico, of course, had no authority whatsoever to make such a statement, which was not true, but at this late hour he probably thought he could lose nothing by being reckless. When the German foreign minister expressed his doubts, Atolico stuck to his view. The French and British declarations, he said, no longer came into consideration. Count Ciano had telephoned only at 8:30 this morning, that is to say at a time when the declarations had already been given out on the radio in Italy. It followed that the two declarations must be considered as superseded. Count Ciano stated, moreover, that France in particular was greatly in favor of the Duce's proposal. The pressure comes at the moment from France, but England will follow. Ribbentrop remained skeptical. He had just discussed Mussolini's proposal with Hitler, he said, and what the Führer wanted to know was, were the Anglo-French notes ultimata? The foreign minister finally agreed to Atolico's suggestion that the Italian envoy should immediately consult Henderson and Coulondre to find out. That was the reason for Atolico's call at the British Embassy. I can still see Atolico, no longer in his first youth, Schmidt, who acted as interpreter, wrote later, running out of Ribbentrop's room and down the steps to consult Henderson and Coulondre. A half hour later, Atolico came running back, as breathless as he had left. Regaining his breath, the Italian ambassador reported that Henderson had just told him the British note was not an ultimatum. Ribbentrop replied that while a German reply to the Anglo-French declarations could only be negative, the Führer was examining the Duce's proposals. And if Rome confirmed that there had been no question of an ultimatum in the Anglo-French declaration, would draft an answer in a day or two. When Atolico pressed for an earlier answer, Ribbentrop finally agreed to reply by noon the next day, Sunday, September 3rd. Meantime, in Rome, Mussolini's hopes were being smashed. At 2 p.m., Ciano received the British and French ambassadors and, in their presence, telephoned to both Halifax and Bonnet, and informed them of Atolico's talks with the German foreign minister. Bonnet was effusive as usual and, according to his own account, in the French Yellow Book, warmly thanked Ciano for his efforts on behalf of peace. Halifax was sterner. He confirmed that the British note was not an ultimatum. One marvels at the splitting of hairs among the statesmen over a single word, for the Anglo-French declarations spoke for themselves unequivocally, but added that in his own view the British could not accept Mussolini's proposal for a conference unless the German armies withdrew from Poland, a matter on which Bonnet again was silent. Halifax promised to telephone Ciano the decision of the British cabinet on that. The decision came shortly after 7 p.m. Britain accepted the Duce's offer on condition that Hitler pull back his troops to the German frontier. The Italian foreign minister realized that Hitler would never accept this and that nothing more could be done, as he put it in his diary. It isn't my business, he added, to give Hitler advice that he would reject decisively and maybe with contempt. I tell this to Halifax, to the two ambassadors, and to the Duce. And finally, I telephone to Berlin that unless the Germans advise us to the contrary, we shall let the conversations lapse. The last note of hope has died. And so, at 8:50 p.m. on September 2nd, the weary and crushed Atolico once more made his way to the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin. This time Ribbentrop received him in the Chancellery, where he was in conference with Hitler. A captured Foreign Office memo records the scene. The Italian ambassador brought the foreign minister the information that the British were not prepared to enter into negotiations on the basis of the Italian proposal of mediation. The British demanded, before starting negotiations, the immediate withdrawal of all German troops from the occupied Polish areas and from Danzig. In conclusion, the Italian ambassador stated that the Duce now considered his mediation proposal as no longer in being. The foreign minister received the communication from the Italian ambassador without comment. Not a word of thanks to the tireless Atolico for all his efforts. Only the contempt of silence toward an ally who was trying to cheat Germany of its Polish spoils. The last slight possibility of averting World War II had now been exhausted. This apparently was obvious to all except one actor in the drama. At 9 p.m., the pusillanimous Bonnet telephoned Ciano, confirmed once more that the French note to Germany did not have the character of an ultimatum, and reiterated that the French government was prepared to wait until noon of September 3rd, the next day, for a German response. However, in order for the conference to achieve favorable results, Bonnet told Ciano, the French government agreed with the British that German troops must evacuate Poland. This was the first time Bonnet had mentioned this, and now only because the British had insisted upon it. Ciano replied that he did not think the Reich government would accept this condition. But Bonnet would not give up. He sought during the night a final escape from France's obligations to the now battered and beleaguered Poland. Ciano recounts this bizarre move in the first paragraph of his diary entry for September 3rd. During the night I was awakened by the ministry because Bonnet had asked Guariglia, the Italian ambassador in Paris, if we could not at least obtain a symbolic withdrawal of German forces from Poland. I throw the proposal in the wastebasket without informing the Duce, but this shows that France is moving toward the great test without enthusiasm and full of uncertainty.